Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. The time is 1:33 p.m. We're in Belts, room 105 of the Thomas Stewart Building in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Friday, February 13th, 2026. I would like to wish everyone a happy Valentine's Day tomorrow. Members present are Senator Ray Jackson, Vice Chair Merrick, Senator Dunbar, Senator Yount is excused, and myself, Senator Bjorkman, is here. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Welcome, everyone, to Senate Labor and Commerce. I'd like to remind everyone to please turn off or silence your cell phones and join me in welcoming our recording secretary, Carrie Tupo, and our LAO moderator, Jude Augustine. We have two items on our agenda today. First up is Senate Bill 196, Behavioral Health Crisis Surcharge Fund. And we'll have our second hearing on Senate Bill 225, Trusts, Trust Proceedings, Trustees. First up, Senate Bill 196. With us to introduce this bill, we have the Honorable Senator Scott Kawasaki and his trustee staff, Jenna Calhoun. Thank you for joining us today in Senate Labor and Commerce. Please put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation of the bill.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, Senator Scott Kawasaki, District P, representing Fairbanks, Fort Wainwright, and Badger. Pleased to be here.
For the record, Jenna Calhoun, staff to Senator Kawasaki.
And I'll just read a brief introduction and statement of Senate Bill 196. 911 is probably the most recognizable phone number in the world. Wherever you're at, it's obvious that if you dial 911, you get the police or the fire department. 988 was a number that was adopted not too long ago, and it has now become the second most recognizable phone number that's out there. And the reason is it's because it's a useful number to know if a person is confronting a behavioral health crisis. Alaska is currently facing that crisis. We have the highest rates of youth suicide in the nation. We have the second highest rates of adult suicide in the nation. Additionally, while most states have seen a decline in opioid-related deaths in recent years, Alaska's has doubled and then relatively stayed flat this last year. Senate Bill 196 proposes to establish a 98-cent monthly surcharge on every wireless phone and wireline telephone number in the state. It creates a dedicated / non-dedicated behavioral health crisis service fund from which to draw fund from. The initiative aims to enhance the state's capacity to respond to more appropriately to mental health emergencies, building upon the behavioral health crisis system of care framework established under House Bill 172 in 2022. At 98 cents per line, Senate Bill 196 is estimated to generate between $6 and $8 million annually in predictable, sustainable funding. Currently, Alaska's behavioral health crisis services rely heavily on dwindling general fund dollars or unstable or temporary federal grant funding and insufficient Medicaid reimbursement rates. As Alaska has transitioned to leveraging federal dollars through the 1115 Medicaid waiver services, there has been a significant decline in funding to behavioral health treatment and recovery grants. This financial instability has led some providers to discontinue or delay implementation of crisis services. By establishing this consistent funding mechanism in law through this proposed surcharge, Alaska can ensure sustainability and expansion of its behavioral health crisis response system. The proposed surcharge would support critical services, including the 988 crisis hotline, mobile crisis teams, crisis stabilization centers, and culturally appropriate outreach programs and services. These services are essential to providing immediate assistance to individuals who are experiencing mental health crises, reducing the burden on emergency departments, law enforcement agencies, and the correctional system. These funds will also facilitate the recruitment and retention of behavioral health professionals, offer specialized training, and support public awareness campaigns to destigmatize mental health issues. So just to summarize, adopting this behavioral health crisis telecom surcharge through SB 196 is a critical step toward strengthening Alaska's mental health infrastructure. By investing in this initiative, Alaska can improve public safety, reduce the strain on emergency department services, and provide better outcomes for those experiencing behavioral health crises. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present Senate Bill 196.
Thank you very much, Senator Kawasaki. At this point in time, we'll take a brief at ease. On the record now, in Senate Labor and Commerce, pardon us for the brief pause while we made some technical adjustments. Thank you very much, Senator Kawasaki, for your introduction of the bill. You now have a presentation for us. Ms. Calhoun.
For the record, Jenna Calhoun, staff to Senator Kawasaki, presenting on SB 196, an act establishing a behavioral health crisis services surcharge, establishing the Behavioral Health Crisis Services Fund, and providing for an effective date. I do have a quote on this first slide that I would like the ask the committee to consider during this presentation. There is no greater agony than the bearing of an untold story inside you. Maya Angelou said it in more poetic terms than I ever could. So what does SB 196, what does it do? First, it does establish a 98% behavioral health crisis services surcharge for each wireline and wireless phone that has a billing address here in Alaska. So it's not just those who have cell phones, it's going to be those who love their landlines as well. Now, wireless telephone customers may not be subject to more than one surcharge per their wireless line. And to continue is customers who have more than 100 local exchange access lines will only be subject to behavioral health services surcharge for the first 100 lines. That actually would apply here to the legislature. We have hundreds of landlines in this capital, so only the first 100 would be subject to this surcharge. Now, it also dictates that the Behavioral Health Crisis Services surcharge must be its own line item on the customer's phone bill. I actually checked my phone bill before I came to this committee and found that 911 has a very similar procedure. That way, the customer will know where their money is going to, but at the same time, this surcharge will be included in the total amount owed by the customer. So they'll be able to see line by line where this 98 cents is going, as well as the 911 services surcharge that is already in effect. This surcharge will not be considered as revenue by the telephone company. In fact, this does also create the expectation that the telephone companies, they will need to remit the behavioral health crisis services surcharge not later than 60 days after the end of the month in which the amount was collected. Now, the incentive for these private companies to do so is they will be entitled to the greater of either 1% of the collected amount or $150 due to the administrative costs that they will incur for collecting this surcharge. And I did a little bit of quick math, and that a revenue of $15,000 would be $150. So most likely it would be the greater of the 1% that they're taking. And that is, again, an incentive and a reward for the phone companies for working with us with SB 196. To continue, it also dictates that the telephone companies are not obligated to take legal action to enforce the collection of the Behavioral Health Crisis Services surcharge. Though, if they do attempt to collect any unpaid debt, they must also attempt to collect any unpaid surcharges. The telephone company on the other end, they must also provide an annual list that includes the name and address of the customers with the unpaid behavioral health crisis services surcharge. At that point in time, the executive branch would be able to make a decision of what they would like to do with that list if they would like to try to collect on those surcharges. Now, SB 196 also would establish the Behavioral Health Crisis Services Fund. This will be contained within the general fund. The Department of Administration will separately account for this surcharge, and then they will deposit that sum into the Behavioral Health Crisis Services Surcharge Fund. With that being said, the legislature will then appropriate the annual estimated balance in the fund to the Department of Health, and they would be able to administer it as they see administer it according to the statutes in SB 196. This statute is estimated to generate $6 to $8 million annually, and I would like to stress that this does not create a dedicated fund. What's the purpose of this fund? Well, it would be to establish, operate, maintain, and improve the 988 initiative to achieve operational and clinical standards. It would be to provide services to a person experiencing a behavioral health crisis. It would be to recruit and retain qualified behavioral health services personnel. We want good people helping us here in Alaska during these moments of crisis. It would also provide specialized training related to at-risk communities, including culturally and linguistically competent behavioral health services. If you don't speak the language, how can you help the person? This fund would ensure that all citizens of Alaska would be able to have someone that they could talk to in a way that they are the most comfortable. It would also provide prevention services tailored to populations that experience higher rates of suicide than the rest of the state. For example, veterans. As we all know, Alaska has the highest proportion of veterans in the U.S. I wonder, they come here. We have the beautiful views. There's a reason that they come here. And this fund would ensure that they get specialized help. Going through PTSD is a different animal than other behavioral health crises. I know this, a little personal information. My father served 2 tours of duty in Desert Storm, 2 tours of duty in Iraq, and as a civilian, 2 tours of duty in Afghanistan. And PTSD is a different animal. Having services tailored to people like my father, these veterans, will make it so they get their help in a more effective way. This would also raise awareness of the 988 number and other behavioral health crisis services available. Why have a system if people don't know about it? If they don't know that they can use it, it will not be utilized. This would also collect, analyze, and report data relevant to the behavioral health crisis services, meaning that this fund would not be administered blindly. We'd be ensuring that data is being used to make informed decisions on what needs to be done in the future to be more effective to help people that have behavioral health crises. And lastly, it would provide administration oversight and evaluate how the Behavioral Health Crisis Services Fund is being administered. This is not a blank check. This is a way for us to fully understand what this money is being used for, and we have it built into the statute that we would continually be analyzing the use of these monies and ensuring that they're being used effectively for the people of Alaska. Now, why is SB 196 needed? As Senator Kawasaki said, Alaska has some of the highest rates of adult and teen suicide. We also have rising rates of overdose deaths as compared to the rest of the country. Now, in 988 number, they fielded 22,458 calls in 2025, and that increased from 16,878 calls in 2024. I got this information from the 988lifeline.org. They have monthly reports of the usage, and I added them up using my trusty calculator. So it's shown that in Alaska, this service is being used, and it's being used more and more. Now, it also alleviated the burden of 911 dispatchers and responders. In 2017, an average of 10% of law enforcement agencies' total budgets and 20% of their staff time was spent responding to mental health crises. They are not specifically trained, while they can field these calls, to handle them. Having a crisis response team that is tailored to the situation is more effective for the individual, and it helps prevent unnecessary incarceration. That's going to help save us some money here in the state as well. And then, again, the current fiscal situation right now does not guarantee stable funding of the current behavioral crisis, health crisis services that were put in place in SB 124 in 2022. This fund would generate income to ensure that these life-saving measures continue. And again, I want to reiterate that we calculated that $6 to $8 million revenue would be generated from this bill. So what's the purpose of the fund? In summation, it's to save Alaskan lives and to save public safety dollars and time. Thank you, committee, to the committee, and I do believe that we do have some invited testimony.
Thank you very much, Ms. Calhoun. Are there any questions for Senator Kawasaki before we go to invited testimony? Hearing and seeing none, up first for invited testimony today is Ms. Angela Kimball. Ms. Kimball, would you please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony?
Yes, Chair Brorsman and members of the committee. My name is Angela Kimball. I'm Chief Advocacy Officer with Inseparable. We are a nonprofit mental health advocacy organization working to close the treatment gap in mental health care, strengthen crisis response systems, and improve youth mental health. And I'm honored to testify today in strong support of SB 196. We all know that Alaska's youth are struggling. The state has the highest rate of teen suicide, and each loss just sends shockwaves through families, communities, in classrooms. One life lost to suicide is too many, but the good news is that we do know what works. As others have said, rapid access to trained 988 counselors, to mobile crisis teams, and to short-term stabilization services can really mean the difference between life and death. And SB 196 would help Alaska continue building a crisis response system grounded in the nationally recognized Crisis Now model, which would ensure that every person in crisis has someone to talk to, someone to respond, and a safe place for help. Most young people can be stabilized through a 988 call, text, or chat support. And when more help is needed, mobile crisis teams and crisis stabilization centers provide that safe, trauma-informed care that connects families to ongoing treatment. And as Senator Kawasaki mentioned, SB 196 establishes a small monthly surcharge, just 98 cents per phone line. And that'll generate, as was just mentioned, approximately $6 to $8 million annually in funding. And I just want to mention that a dozen states, including Washington and Oregon, have already adopted a 988 surcharge like you're considering today. And I know the 988 crisis services this would fund saves lives, not only as an advocate, but as a parent. My son experienced a severe mental health crisis in my hometown of Portland, Oregon, and a mobile crisis team responded with such compassion and skill. He was really manic and agitated, but they listened and they empathized. And after hearing everything that had happened, they said, "Alex, it sounds like you haven't been able to get any sleep for several days and your head is hurting." And he said, yes, I just like to get to sleep and I can't. And they said, we have a doctor who could help you get to sleep. Would you be willing to go with us to the Crisis Stabilization Center? And he said, yes. And it was there that he got the interventions that kept him safe and gave our family hope. And every Alaska family deserves to know that that help will be there when they need it most. I respectfully urge you to advance SB 196, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your presentation, Ms. Kimball. Are there any questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing none, we'll go next to Chief Sean Case. Chief Case, will you please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony, please?
Yes, my name is Sean Case. I'm the Chief of Police for the Anchorage Police Department, Chair Bjorkman, Vice Chair Merrick, and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 196. This legislation represents a critical investment in Alaska's public safety and public health systems by ensuring that individuals experiencing behavioral health crisis receive the right care at the right time. It is time we started thinking about criminal justice problems also as a public health problem. SB 196 proposes a modest monthly surcharge to fund behavioral health crisis services, including the operation and improvements of the 988 crisis line system, crisis response teams, and related infrastructure. The bill ensures that funds are used to support and expand crisis response services statewide, recruit and retrain qualified behavioral health professionals, provide culturally competent and community-based care, and increase public awareness of availability of crisis services. For law enforcement agencies like the Anchorage Police Department, this bill is not just about funding mental health services. It's about transforming how we respond to people in crisis. Every day, our officers encounter individuals struggling with mental illness, substance use, and suicidal ideations. Too often, these situations escalate because these are limited alternatives to arrest and emergency detention. This matters to law enforcement because arresting someone in crisis is not always the right answer. It can temporarily remove a person from a dangerous situation, but it rarely addresses the underlying cause of the behavior. Without access to timely behavioral health care, many individuals cycle repeatedly through our jails, emergency rooms, and streets. This is costly, ineffective, and deeply frustrating for officers who want to help but lack the tools and resources to do so. By strengthening Alaska's behavioral crisis system, SB 196 will reduce unnecessary arrests and jail bookings. For individuals whose primary issue is mental health or substance use crisis, free up police resources to focus on crime prevention and community safety. It improves officer safety by providing trained crisis responders who can de-escalate volatile situations. And it will connect people to care, reducing repeat calls for service and long-term public safety costs. The Anchorage Police Department strongly supports SB 196 because it aligns with our vision to create an environment where everybody matters. We know that public safety and public health are deeply connected. By investing in behavioral health crisis services, we can reduce crime, improve outcome for vulnerable individuals, and make Anchorage and all of Alaska a safer, healthier place to live. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much, Chief Case. Any questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing none, Chief Case, thanks again for being with us today. We'll go next to our third public testifier, or invited testifier, I should say, Mr. Dennis Lashley. Will you please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony? Mr. Lashley, can you hear us?
Oh, I'm sorry. The phone cut out when you guys introduced me. I apologize.
Oh, that's quite all right. We can hear you now.
Perfect. So my name is Dennis Lashley. and I am the vice president of the Anchorage Police Department Employees Association. I am also a police dispatch lead with the Anchorage Police Department and serve as the chair for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention Alaska chapter. I would like to thank you guys for allowing me to testify on behalf of SB 196 and the importance that this bill can play with providing a sustainable fund for behavioral health and crisis intervention. I'd like to speak a little bit through my professional lens as a 911 dispatch supervisor with 17 years of experience in law enforcement. On average, we receive approximately 60 to 70 calls per day with individuals that are experiencing some form of crisis. And those calls would be the ones that we actually currently transfer to the 988 care line in Fairbanks. We receive probably two times to almost three times that total quantity every month. So of that, the between 60 and 70 that we transferred to the care line allows us to provide a, one, better service to that individual that's in crisis because we are putting them in contact with a trained behavior health specialist that can better address the concerns and the needs that they have as a citizen. And two, it allows our 911 call takers to now be available to address other emergencies or concerns that come in to the city itself. So from an operations and efficiency standpoint, certainly allows us the ability to be more efficient and better address the citizens that are within our area, but again, allows us to provide a level of care by referring that individual that's in crisis to a center that is better qualified and higher trained than we are as it relates to trying to de-escalate and deal with someone's mental health crisis. Obviously, that doesn't mean that every call that we get might not be a police response. There are certain times where law enforcement is necessary for those that are experiencing crisis based on the circumstances. But for those lower level instances, the care line is a fantastic resource and tool that should be used, and this funding would allow for them to better staff and provide better training for their individuals. Based on data that's available on the 988 care line website, for the months of January going back through August, on average, they spent anywhere between 14 and 18 minutes with each of their callers. If that was a 911 operator that stayed on the line with someone, again, that's between 14 and 18 minutes that that operator is addressing that crisis and no longer able to assist other in-progress crises that might be taking place throughout the city. So I would just like you guys to put some serious consideration into the idea of creating the sustainable fund and properly funding and addressing the mental health crisis that we have in Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lashley. We appreciate you participating today. Are there any questions or comments from committee members? Hearing and seeing none, we will go to our fourth and final invited testifier of the day, but I believe that he has dropped off. If Ms. Calhoun, I would love it if you could read his testimony.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. I'm going to read the comments as if I were the invited testifier. Through the chair, my name is James Baeya. I live in Bethel, and I'm testifying today in support of Senate Bill 196. As a co-founder and volunteer with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, Alaska chapter, and as vice chair of National Public Policy for AFSP, professionally, I am a full-time itinerant school social worker, a role I have held for 21 years. In my work, I'm on the front lines supporting students at risk, responding to student deaths by suicide, and serving as a first responder in villages following suicide deaths. I have seen firsthand the devastating impact suicide has on families, schools, and entire communities. Alaska continues to face one of the highest suicide rates in the nation. Our suicide rate is nearly double the national average, and suicide remains one of the leading causes of death for our young people in our state. For Alaska Native people, the disparity is even greater, with rates several times higher than the U.S. average. In parts of western Alaska, including communities in the YK Delta, the impact of suicide is persistent and deeply felt across generations. These are not abstract statistics. They are classrooms with empty desks, families navigating grief, and communities carrying cumulative trauma. In my work at the YK Delta, I have seen firsthand the heartbreak of parents losing children, friends losing peers, and entire villages grappling with the weight of these losses. It is personal, and it is urgent. Many communities are off the road system. Travel depends on small aircraft, and weather can delay transport for hours or even days. Access to inpatient behavioral health care often requires air travel, and in many villages, there is no emergency department or local crisis stabilization facility. When someone is in acute crisis, experiencing suicidal thoughts, overwhelming depression, or behavioral health emergency, 988 may be the only immediate connection available. Caroline, Alaska, our state's 988 call center, answered more than 24,000 calls last year alone. This demonstrates that Alaskans are reaching out for help, and when they do, someone must be there to answer. Caroline was also one of the first centers in the country to join the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline in 2005, reflecting Alaska's long-standing leadership in crisis care. But strong systems require stable funding, not just legacy or goodwill. SB 196 establishes a dedicated behavioral health crisis services surcharge and fund, ensuring long-term stability for 988 call, text, and chat services, as well as the broader crisis continuum, including mobile crisis response and crisis stabilization. This builds on the Crisis Now framework authorized by SB 124 in 2022, which is designed to reduce the burden on law enforcement, emergency departments, and correctional facilities, while ensuring individuals in crisis receive timely, appropriate care. Without sustainable funding, these systems cannot function effectively, particularly in rural and tribal communities already facing workforce shortages and geographic barriers. Relying on temporary federal grants or one-time appropriations creates uncertainty for providers, limits workforce recruitment, and threatens continuity of care. SB 196 ensures that when someone in a remote village reaches out in their darkest moment, the call is answered. The counselor is trained and ready, and a pathway for follow-up care exists. In rural Alaska, timing matters. A delayed response can mean the difference between stabilization and tragedy. Every Alaskan deserves immediate access to compassionate, culturally responsive crisis care, regardless of where they live. And in the YK Delta, I have seen the profound difference timely support can make, how a single phone call can stabilize a family, prevent a loss, and provide hope where it is desperately needed. On behalf of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, Alaska Center, and the communities we serve across the state, I respectfully urge you to advance SB 196. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. James Baella.
Thank you for reading that, Ms. Calhoun. Senator Kawasaki, we'll bring it back to you. Do you have any wrap-up comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the records. Senator Scott Kawasaki, Fairbanks, Fort Wainwright, and Badger. I just wanted to thank the committee for hearing this Senate Bill 196 this afternoon. Also wanted to thank the folks who had been online to testify in person. There's also a series of letters from other various stakeholders and folks who also support the bill, including the Alaska Native Health Board, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill Alaska Chapter, Matsu Reentry Coalition, and the City of Fairbanks. I think this is a good step forward as we try to figure out how we can pay for the services that we can really use. I'll just say again that, you know, since the law enforcement was present and able to talk about the difference really between the 911 call and the 988 call, I think it's so important as we try to figure out how to sort of address these mental health crises in a better, proactive way. And also at the same time, be able to figure out how we budget in a better way. And these dollars will go directly to support those behavioral health services, and then thus needing less for the public safety side of that equation. So I also wanted just to end that, you know, when a person dials 988, they're not going to get an AI chatbot. They're not going to get the sort of thing that you would expect in these cost-cutting days and times. They're going to get a real person. They're going to get a person who is trained in the situation and has the situational awareness to be able to talk a person down. And I think that's really important to add to this whole context, because a lot of those folks who are at the end of this 988 line are survivors, or they've been somehow involved in this particular lifeline situation. And so the training that comes along with the money that will be coming forward during this 988 surcharge, I think, is incredibly valuable for the whole behavioral health and mental health system. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki. I have, I think, one question. So I think I've heard some conversations around other tax income streams that the state has to be specifically directed toward behavioral health. One of those is a tax on cannabis. Can you talk a little bit about that and other revenue streams that are being used to fund behavioral health now, and why they're inadequate, in your opinion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try my best because I did a little bit of research over the cannabis tax that's coming forward. You know, the state share of that cannabis tax, people say, well, why can't you just balance the budget on that? That would take an awful lot of each individual's evening time to be able to pay for the budget deficit that we have now. It only really brings in, I think, somewhere between $40 and $60 million in total. This dollar per landline, per cell phone line, will bring in close to $6 to $8 million, which is a pretty significant portion if you think about it. I think the other thing to say is that when we introduced the alcohol tax, the wholesale alcohol tax, sent decades ago now, that was sort of the idea, was that alcohol tax would go to health. It obviously never kept up with that. And as we see alcohol receipts go down across the state and in individual communities, you'll also see the amount of revenue that goes to those particular services drop. And I think that's where we're at right now. Again, this is another way to stabilize funding for behavioral health. We think it's a really great investment.
Thank you. Any further questions or comments from committee members? I'm wondering if next time we hear this bill, we could have someone from revenue come and chat about kind of that specifically, about those different revenue streams that are directed toward behavioral health possibly, but not dedicated.
Thank you. And I will actually mention that even locally, some local alcohol taxes or cannabis taxes in my municipality, I know, and I think Anchorage too at least, do try to direct that funding to public safety, for instance. And so again, there's putting money into the public safety fund or public safety budgets. But again, 911 isn't the number to call when a person has a behavioral health crisis. It's 988. And as 988 continues to grow, hopefully it'll continue to drop the costs associated with 911 services.
Very good. Well, thank you very much, and we'll see you again soon. At this time, we will set Senate Bill 196 aside for further consideration at a future hearing, and we'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. Back on the record now, next up on our agenda for today is Senate Bill 225. It's our second hearing on this bill. Last Friday, we heard a presentation of the bill. We took invited testimony from the Division of Banking and Security staff. Today, it is my intention to have a recap of the bill, take public testimony, and have committee discussion. With us today, we have the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Anna Latham. Thank you for being with us today. Could you please provide a brief recap of the bill?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Bjorkman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Anna Latham. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 225 again today. Since it is a 26-section bill, I'll just go through the major changes with your indulgence, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 225 requires courts to seal records. South Dakota is the only other state currently that has this requirement. This would protect sensitive family, financial, and business information. It expands non-judicial settlement agreements, and Alaska is not a uniform code state for trusts, so now all non-binding agreements must go through the courts. And this would reduce court involvement and costs in setting up a trust. SB 225 creates a statutory process for allowing trusts and other fiduciaries to give advance notice of proposed actions. And the largest change in this bill is a major expansion of trust decanting. This allows broader authority to open up a trust and make changes, such as adding or removing beneficiaries. The other changes are SB 225 sets a clear fiduciary standard for decanting decisions, and it provides for stronger asset protection trust rules. It shortens the creditor look-back period so that it's harder to defraud a creditor by putting assets into a trust. This area of law has not had major changes since 1995 when it was established, 1997, excuse me, and Alaska was known as the strongest state in the nation at that time to charter a trust. And so the impetus of this bill is to create economic activity, especially in the financial sector, by strengthening Alaska's trust statutes.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Deputy Commissioner Latham? Senator Dunbar.
Sir, Mr. Chair, what I want to say is I do have some questions, but my understanding is that there's some invited testimony first, so I might hold until after that unless they're not online.
We have some people who are available for questions, and those people are Chief Assistant Attorney General for the State of Alaska, the Department of Law, Amy Robinson. Tracy Reno is also joining us via the phone from the Division of Banking and Securities. Ryan Dukowitz is also with us. He is a financial examiner, together with Matthew Blattmacher. It's probably not how you say that, but he is also here. He is the president of Peak Trust, and I believe he is marked for public testimony or invited. Public testimony. Very good. And then our friendly neighborhood general counsel to the Alaska Court System, Nancy Mead, is online as well. Would you like to ask any of those people questions?
No, Mr. Chair, I'll wait till after public testimony before I begin the questions. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Hearing and seeing none, at this time, I'll open public testimony on Senate Bill 225. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify to this item? Seeing no one, we'll go online to public testimony. And Mr. Blattmacher, if you could please state your name and affiliation and begin your testimony.
Yes, my name is Matthew Blattmacher, president and CEO of Peak Trust Company, which is a public trust company headquartered in Alaska. Calling in today to express support of Senate Bill 225 and appreciate the committee's time and attention to it. I think there are, you know, quickly three key points to this bill. Really, why it matters for Alaskans is that it produces continued great opportunities for Alaska to do great estate planning. And, of course, if there's two things we know that are given in life, it's death and taxes. So everyone will have to go through an estate planning process at some point. It matters for Alaska's economy and competitiveness. And afterwards, I'm happy to send a document that substantiates this. The industry brings a number of jobs and money to our state banking system that diversifies our economy away from resource extraction. And it's a good, clean industry, good, clean jobs. And this bill not only improves Alaska's law, but it also provides some clarity. And there's a different bill that we've introduced on behalf of a group called ATEP that really does nothing more than introduce clarity to Alaska's existing law. So this bill, in many ways, is an enhancement to what we already have rather than creating something completely new. I don't believe that this bill expands risks, weakens oversight, or creates loopholes. It simply clarifies and modernizes Alaska's law. I respectfully encourage the support. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Blattmacher. Senator Dunbar has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Blattmacher. And I want to ask you a few questions just because you're a practitioner in this industry, but if you don't feel comfortable answering them, then I will ask them of the Division of Banking afterwards. Can you give us a sense of the kind of trusts that are sort of implicated by this bill and sort of the size of that typical trust?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, the typical trust that Peak Trust Company sees is are those where the client has elected to use a corporate trustee. And a corporate trustee obviously comes with a fee. So what we see are larger trusts on average. And the average there is probably $10 million plus. Now, that doesn't account for the thousands, tens of thousands of Alaskans who have trusts in the state that they don't need a corporate trustee or they don't want a corporate trustee. And in many ways, the size of those is probably significantly smaller, although there are some that are, you know, quite large in size.
Very good. Can you speak a little bit about the shortening of the look back period for creditors? It's going from 4 years to 1 year. What does that mean, practically speaking?
Sure. Senator Dunbar, through the chair. So shortening that credit period makes Alaska competitive with other states. As was mentioned in the opening testimony, the Alaska legislature in 97 passed what was then a groundbreaking law, which was the Alaska Trust Act. And that really kicked off a race, if you will, for all other states to modernize their trust laws. It was that groundbreaking. And one of the things that it changed was it established what is a creditor and what is a pre-existing creditor. And I believe Alaska has some of the best defined definitions of that, of any state. So shortening that makes Alaska competitive with other states and where someone can provide asset preservation for themselves. In many ways, asset preservation, I think, comes with a bad connotation because people think, well, you're trying to defraud someone. But anyone who has created an LLC has engaged in asset preservation. This is essentially the same thing, just using trusts. And it shortens the period of time in which someone who is a pre-existing creditor can bring claims against someone who has put assets inside of trust. It doesn't mean that they can't continue to go after that person individually. It just sets aside the assets in that trust.
So practically speaking, it means is it sort of similar to a statute of limitations then? So right now the look back period is 4 years. So a creditor has 4 years to maybe realize that they are owed money or otherwise seek the money from the person putting in the trust. And this would shorten that time period from 4 years to 1 year before they lose that legal opportunity. Is that an accurate description of what the bill does?
That is correct.
Okay. I think that's all the questions I have for you. Thank you so much for your testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Thank you for joining us today, sir. We appreciate you.
Oh, dang it, I did have.
No, oh, it's fine. Senator Dunbar has one more question.
I'm sorry, Mr. Blottmacher. Is there – there? It's a very long and very complicated bill. If we were to pass just a portion of it or say most of it, would that accomplish some of the competitiveness goals and sort of which of the sections in here do you see as sort of the most important for your purposes?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, absolutely. I mean, the bill is very robust in making Alaska competitive. And again, you know, Alaska was the first state to kick this off. And so we started off, you know, the race in our, you know, first place. And other states have moved quicker in the last almost 30 years. It's kind of wild it's been that long. So this bill really gets us back up into the top, you know, three, if you will, of states in this. If we pass a portion of it, or if the legislature only passed a portion of it, it would have benefits. It's obviously not all of the benefits. What is most important to the industry is the non-judicial settlement agreement, decanting, and the notice of proposed action. All of them are important and valuable to the state. If I had to rank the top three, those would be the top three.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. That was unusually informative testimony, or unusually specific. Sometimes people dance around things. I really appreciate how informative that was. Thank you.
Very well. Okay. Deputy Director or Deputy Commissioner Latham, would you like to have any closing comments or wrap up today?
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman, members of the committee. I just want to thank you again for hearing this bill. It's very important to the division to look at diversifying our economy, and we very much appreciate you entertaining these hearings.
Very good. Thank you very much. As we're not going to move the – oh, Senator Dunbar, do you have a question?
I have quite a few questions.
Okay.
If we could have some discussion about this bill.
Yes.
Okay. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Latham, for being here. You know, it is a very dense bill, so I'm still learning about it and had a good conversation with the Department of Law today about it. And a few issues, and I think that public testimony helped me understand as well. You know, we had requested from, I think my office had requested from your division, I believe it was your division, you know, what is the average size of a trust? But I think we were asking the wrong question, because the answer we got back from you was, you know, 1.5 to 2 million, depending on the year, not from you, but from the division. And but in my discussions with the Department of Law, and I think what we did, the conversation we just had with our public testifier, the kind of trusts that are implicated by most of the provisions here are actually significantly larger. When we're talking about out-of-state trusts coming into Alaska being competitive, we're talking about tens of millions, usually. And I think that sort of informs some of my understanding of what this bill does and sort of where it's from and what it's for, right? So you've mentioned that South Dakota is – with the first section, South Dakota is the only other state to adopt it. And, you know, South Dakota is known for having very unusually lenient rules on credit card companies, for example, that make it very hard for a consumer to bring actions against credit card companies. And so they've become sort of a haven for credit card companies, I think, to the harm for most credit card users in the country. And I sort of want to discuss about, you know, is this a race to the bottom in some way where we are doing things that are perhaps counter to the public interest? But that's only for certain provisions. I'll say the decanting provisions to me seem common sense. The non-judicial provisions we heard from Nancy Mead, I think, will be welcomed by the court system. That makes sense too. For me, the sections that really stand out are Section 1, having to do with sort of removing from the public eye a lot of what is happening in these very large trusts, and then that look-back provision. And I think your quote was harder to defraud a creditor, but that doesn't, to me, sound like what's actually going on. I mean, could you help me understand that? So what it does is, if you're a creditor, it shortens the amount of time that you can bring an action against a trust, someone putting these assets in trust. So doesn't it actually make it easier to defraud a creditor because they have less time in which to sort of catch you in the act?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, it does make the trust more attractive because it is a shorter amount of time. But I would defer to Department of Law as far as real-life examples, perhaps.
Okay. I'll say my conversation with Department of Law, they said I had to talk to you because of the policy call. But if they have some examples, I'd like to hear them for sure. And
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, my understanding, just for the committee's edification, as far as Section 1 with sealing records, South Dakota is the only state that has this requirement currently, but the clawback periods or the creditor look-back periods, my understanding is that there's multiple states and that's more of an industry standard, that Alaska is most stringent in that 4 years.
Okay. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I don't want to wait.
No, that's okay. All right. If you need a break, I believe that General Counsel of the Alaska Court System, Nancy Mead, might be willing to put some more clarity around Section 1, if you like.
We can do that. I have policy questions around Section 1 that I don't think implicate the court system.
Okay.
I think I understand what the court system is doing there. I think the question is why we are asking them to do it. When only South Dakota does it, right? Can you speak a little bit about where Section 1 came from? That is, were there people in the industry that came to you and said, we need to do this? Was this something that the governor's office brought to the department? Was it someone from South Dakota that brought it? Like, where did this idea come from?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, as we've all discussed in the past few years, there's lots of Alaska's on the precipice of major development in many sectors of the economy. And this was from the administration to strengthen our trust statutes. So it did come from the administration.
So can you explain, other than the desire to have, you know, very wealthy individuals and, you know, sort of put their assets into these kind of accounts in Alaska. Not that they would come to Alaska, but they put their assets here. What public interest does it serve to remove these records? Because right now they're public records, right, that go through the court system. What is the public interest in removing these records from sort of public scrutiny?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, this just protects sensitive family, financial, and business information. It would protect those records.
Right. I think when people hear that, they think, you know, leaving the house to my kid or, you know, something. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about usually, you know, tens of millions, very large estates, tens of millions of dollars. Not just estates, but, you know, setting up these trusts. Can I ask, so in subsection 7, it talks about a compelling public interest to access these. So there are folks that can access these documents if they can go and demonstrate a public interest. Would a journalist have a public interest in being able to see these documents?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, I would defer to law as far as exactly, or the courts, on the practical application of who would have a public interest in seeing those.
Can we speak to the Department of Law, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Who from the Department of Law is online?
Amy Robinson.
Ms. Robinson, can you speak to whether a journalist would have a narrowly tailored compelling interest to view these documents?
Thank you. For the record, Amy Robinson, Senior Assistant Attorney General for the Department of Law. Through the chair, in response to Senator Dunbar, Your question, if I understand it correctly, is whether a journalist would have access to these records. Is that correct?
Yes.
I think that the journalist would be required to present evidence to the court that there's a compelling public interest to be served by granting access to the information. Here in paragraph 7, as drafted, there's a clear and convincing evidence standard. I don't believe that that's your concern. That's very customary in Title 13 to use that standard, but that perhaps you're more honed in on disclosure if it's narrowly tailored for a compelling public interest.
Yes.
That standard would align with a fundamental protection, for example, of the right to privacy, and it would be intended to protect the trustors. I do not have specific examples in reference to the prior conversation here today, but I hope that that helps to establish a little bit of parameters around it and what a court might look to when requested to disclose.
Yeah, I'll just say, I mean, for those of us who have had the opportunity to study law, narrowly tailored for a compelling public interest is a very high standard. It's almost the highest standard you can have in the law. It's for protection of fundamental rights, like you mentioned, the right to privacy within one's own body, the right to free speech, and even then only in certain circumstances. I mean, it's a very high standard and usually leads to things being either thrown out or struck down. Yeah, it's striking to have it in a law, in my opinion, that has to do with financial records. Other questions on this? So for the Division of Banking, if we were to put some kind of floor to this, like let's say for trusts larger than $2.5 million. Would that accomplish part of what you for trusts smaller than 2.5 million, you'd have these privacy protections, but for very large trusts larger than 2.5 million, for example, the current law would still apply. Would that accomplish any percentage of the goal you are seeking, or does it have to be a sort of straight up or down?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, we'd certainly want to see the bill pass out of committee without those type of restrictions, because the way it's currently drafted makes it most attractive to charter trusts in the state. However, we'd work with the committee on any amendments or CSs that were introduced.
If someone had a child support judgment or something along those lines, and were seeking to enforce that judgment or to pursue assets, would this section do anything to make it more difficult for that person to effectuate their judgment?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, I would like to defer that to Department of Law because I'm not completely familiar with how the child support claims are handled currently.
Okay. Could I – you said Ms. Mead is online?
Yes.
Ms. Mead, would you be willing to describe sort of the kind of court records that currently are available for public view that would be shielded from public view if we pass this law?
Yes, thank you, Senator Dunbar, through the chair. And for the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. The court system is the depository for registration of Alaskan trusts, and we do get many, many trusts registered. I'm looking at data that says we get between, looks like 1,300 a year and 1,700 a year trust registrations. But what's important is we do not keep the trust document itself. People fill out the trust registration and pay a small filing fee, and we have that case opened and closed the same day. It just establishes, satisfies the statutory requirement that they have been in Alaska and registered that piece of paper. That is public, but all it is a piece of paper declaring there's a trust. It does not have any further information on it regarding, you know, who anybody is or how much money might be at stake. What Section 1 is speaking to is when there is a petition, and I'm looking at page 1, line 8, filed under 1336060. So those are cases where people are litigating something about the trust, where they don't like something the trustee is doing, for example, and thinks that, you know, there may be some illegality involved, or there is something at issue that needs the court's review and decision. So the vast majority of trusts don't end up there. And just for order of magnitude, the other data I was able to get shows that the number of trust cases filed a year hovers around 30. So those are the only cases that Section 1 would apply to. Right now, those cases are public, meaning somebody can come in and look at the file, just like you can for a criminal file, because that's the default unless the legislature or the court makes files confidential. As it happens with those 30 cases, under court rules, there's ways to get public cases made confidential, and in a good percentage of those, people seek to have them made confidential because they can establish that their interest in privacy outweighs the public's interest in knowing what's in those litigation files. Section 1 would reverse that and make all those, and again, we're just talking those 30 or so cases, you know, maybe up to 40 some years, confidential, and some people could obtain access under the wording in that sub 7 that you were looking at on page 7. People could ask to look at a confidential file. There's already something in law about wills saying they're confidential, and people can get at them, as in, you know, be able to copy the records and look at them if they show good cause. And so it's kind of like a parallel provision. It's a parallel provision with a little different wording. And that may be something that the legislature wants to look at, that is making them confidential, but for good cause shown, somebody could have access to them. Has that clarified anything for you, Senator?
Yes. Thank you, Ms. Mead. That's very helpful. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's the last question I have for the division. And you'd mentioned that going from that 4 years for the look back is a sort of a not an aberration example exactly, but it's unusual. Is the industry standard 1 year, or would that make us also sort of out of step in the other direction? That is, if it was 2 years or 2.5 years, is that more in line with what we see in other parts of the country?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, my understanding is it's 1 year is the industry standard, but I'll follow up with the committee and get you some statistics on that.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Deputy Commissioner, thank you for joining us today. Do you have any closing comments before we set the bill aside?
Thank you.
All right. We will leave public testimony open as we are going to take this bill up at a later date. Hearing no further questions or discussion about Senate Bill 225 today, we will set the bill aside. The Senate Labor and Commerce Committee will meet again on Monday. We will take up some bills which are on the schedule and are not the bills that are on this piece of paper, but you can look to the schedule that is posted on BASIS. And as there is no further questions or business to come before the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, we are adjourned at 2:44 p.m.